Okay, this is March 5th, 2012. We're here with Titus Fields at Sam Houston State University for a course on the Huntsville POW camp. And we're going to have Mr. Fields introduce himself, then we'll have questions from students in the class. So would you just introduce yourself to everybody? I know you already introduced yourself to people here.
Yeah, name's Titus Fields, F-I-E-L-D-S, T-I-T-U-S, F-I-E-L-D-S. And I'll be 86 years old in 10 more days, and still kicking. But anyway, from the beginning, we moved from Louisiana to Texas. And the war was coming on, and at the time the war broke out when Pearl Harbor was bombed in 1941. I was delivering the Houston Morning Post, and I was also delivering the Afternoon Press. And the way I found out about the war, the Second World War, was when Pearl Harbor was bombed. It's through the news. I picked up the paper, and there it was. I didn't realize what country it happened in, even. I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, anything like that. I was just a kid. But anyway, that started it right there. And then the war, while this was going on, I was living at home with my dad and lots of relatives. Because when the war broke out, it seemed like everybody in Louisiana moved to Houston, getting these defense jobs at the shipyards and everything. And there were 17 people living in this two-bedroom house we had. And they slept on pallets from wall to wall. Everywhere was somebody laying on the floor. And they had three shifts working. And the kitchen went 24 hours a day because you had to feed these people. Well, that's when I found out I wouldn't get my square meals. They took my bed, and if I didn't get in there in time to eat, there was nothing left. Everything was eaten when I'd get home. So I decided then there's got to be a better way. So what I done, I was 17 years old. I went and volunteered to join the Army. And they said, well, we'll have to get your age, we'll have to get your parents' consent. So I got consent from my parents and was inducted in Houston into the Army and went to Fort Sam Houston, took my basics. And after that, we got on buses and come to Riverside. That's this prison base here, this prison camp at Riverside, German prison camp. And that's where I started my working guard there. And it was all strange to me. I was just a kid, but our prisoners in this camp, were some of them were younger than me, and I was 17 years old. Some of them were younger than me, because Hitler picked it didn't matter. If you could carry a gun or march, you were in the service over there. He took you in. And so you had 14, 15-year-old kids fighting in Africa when that's where the fighting started. And incidentally, these prisoners we had there were the cream of the crop. That's what they call the cream of the crop, the best. The best soldiers. And they were captured in North Africa. They were the first prisoners that were captured. They were captured in North Africa. And then they shipped them to the States because they couldn't handle them overseas. And that's where it all began, right here in camp, in Riverside. Excuse me, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here anyway.
Well, so when did you get there about? Like what year and what season did you get there?
I was in Fort Sam Houston taking basics in February of 43.
Okay.
And after taking my basic there, about 2 months I shipped over to Riverside at the prison base. So I was still 17 years old when I entered this camp here. But anyway, any questions I'll answer. But the thing is, these prisoners were model prisoners. They had the best food. They ate as well as we did. What we ate, they had. They ate also. And their cooks were excellent. Our cooks couldn't fry eggs. these cooks, these German prisoners that were cooked, were excellent cooks. And I don't care what you took in the kitchen, in that mess hall, they could fix it where it was presentable. You could eat it. And that's what I loved the best, because I could eat back then, man. I was a young man, and I could. When we first got to this base in Riverside, they said, you're gonna ride guard inside the compound. Well, that meant a horse. So they took me to the stable, and then they issued me a horse that, I forget the number, it was in the 20s, it had a number on it. And I didn't like that. I said, I'm going to name you Old Joe. So Old Joe was my horse. But he was from the old cavalry. He was a very old horse, but he come from the cavalry, Army cavalry. They still had a few left, and they were using him. That's the reason his name's Old Joe, because he was very old. I had him, and I'd ride in. We'd go in the compounds and ride over the prisoners, just go keep peace, keep the peace, and watch them, see that they didn't get in trouble and all. But you wouldn't allow in there with a weapon whatsoever. No weapons. When you went through that main gate, you didn't have a weapon. You went in there with a stick, and that was your protection. You couldn't raise a hand to one of them or slap him or correct him or anything. That was somebody else's job. You were just a guard. And as far as if you were to strike one and it were reported, you were in trouble. You went to put us in the brig. We never had a problem. Every now and then, the alarm would go off. Somebody got out. Somebody had escaped. Well, one morning, one night, four of them escaped. So they got to looking for them. You know where they found them? Behind the walls here in Huntsville. They were crouched down behind the walls here in the back of the prison, right here in Huntsville. Yeah. And that's where they located. They weren't going anywhere. They didn't have no place to go. They didn't know who to turn to, anything. So we went and picked them up and just took them back to base. But whenever they get out, we had 20 horses, ride horses, and work horses. And we had the same amount of bloodhounds. We had 20 bloodhounds on the base there at one time. And if one of them got out, or any of them got out, you let them bloodhounds go. And they're going to find a tree or run back and try to climb in the fence inside there where they could get away from them dogs. And all you had to do was go get them then. There was no problem. When that dog started baying, you knew you had one in a tree. So you'd go get him, take him back to camp. Well, they'd done their own punishing. We didn't punish them. They had non-commissioned officers on that base, German prisoners. They were you didn't have no commissioned officers at all on this base. This was from non-coms down to the yard birds. They took care of the highest ranking one in the compound, the prisoners, were equivalent to first sergeant, our first sergeant. That's the top rank in that. And they judged them. They punished them. If they'd done something wrong, that was their job to take care of that. So we didn't have to tend to that, see. Unless it was something real serious. And we never had anything serious in that base. I mean, they were model prisoners. They had the best to eat. We'd pick up commodities down here in Riverside at the station. They had a train station that one time. They'd park these boxcars in there. I've never seen so many arsh potatoes in my life. Boxcar loads of rice, beans, potatoes, dry goods all come through the railroad station. We'd go pick it up and take it back to the camp. And in the camp, we had a a cold storage area. That's where they kept the cheese, the butter, and the meat. And they had that there. And like I said, they ate exactly what we ate, and only with better. They fix their food a whole lot better. And but anyhow.
Now, you were there from then, it sounds like, say, May of 43, roughly, to you, once you turned 18, what happened? Tell everybody what happened then.
Well, I was at this base here, and the captain called me in his office one day, and he says, Fields, he asked me, he says, how long you been a servant? I told him, give him a serial number and everything. And he says, how old are you? I said, well, I'm 18. Well, I'm going to be 18. I said, I wasn't 18 yet, but I was going to be 18. I tell him, I'm officially turned 18. He says, well, he says, I'm afraid we're going to have to send you off somewhere else. So I found out I was fixing to take training to go overseas. So they sent me to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana, and I took my training there. And when they got ready to ship us, they put us on a train. And these trains had, they were Pullman cars with seats in them. And we went from Louisiana to New York without even getting off of the Pullmans. No bed, nothing. You just slept in your seat. And they had these curtains pulled down. And these cars, everything was in blackout, in other words. Nobody knew the troop movements or anything. See, that was during the war. So your troop movements were quiet. And the only people you'd see was Red Cross people. We'd stop in the middle of the woods somewhere, so out on a prairie somewhere, and here come these people. You never stop in a city. You stopped out in the rural areas, and they'd come to you, and the Red Cross was wonderful. Coffee, donuts, stuff like that. Good company, you know. And we ended up in New York, anyhow. They put us on a ship. Well, it was in the wintertime. I think it was either December or January. And it was ice and snow everywhere. They put us on this ship. Well, the thing is, when we got on this train, we went all the way to New York in the dark. Didn't see nothing. Got there, and they took us in a mountain range where there was a camp. We didn't see the city of New York or nothing. This camp. And we took overseas training there. And then when they moved us from there, but on the Underground Railroad to the docks in New York, I figured I'd see New York City. No, this was all underground, and when we got to the ship back, the city was behind us in about a 100-foot wall there. You didn't see nothing. So we got on the ship, and I didn't even get to see. We sailed by the Statue of Liberty, but it was fogging. The water was fogging and everything. We didn't even get to see it. And they had the lights out anyway. And it was all total darkness. But we got out about 4 or 5 days out. We were running around on that ship in shorts. We then got into the Gulf Channel.
Yeah.
And it's warm out there where it's freezing in New York. Four days out in the water, you're out there in shorts. But then when we got to England, it was cold. You know, they bedded us down in a stable, and we had big troughs there with hay in them. That's where we slept. Slept in them troughs. That's where we went across the channel. That's ship channel into France. But we're getting away from the prison thing.
You basically served in both Europe and in the Pacific theater later.
Yes.
In the Philippines.
When I was in Germany, we got up to the Rhine River, and the Russians, we were on the Western Front, moving toward Berlin, and the Russians were on the Eastern Front. Well, they took Berlin before we ever got there. So we stopped more or less on the Rhine. That's midway. Mm-hmm. And the German prisoners, the German fighters, the soldiers, come to us to where they wouldn't surrender to the Russians, because the Russians were crooked. They'd shoot you on the spot. I mean, if they didn't like the looks, you were dead. I mean, that's the way it was. And I thought I seen prisoners here in Riverside, but nothing like over there. They come in multitudes. They come to us because they knew the Americans would treat them right. So they surrendered to us on the west side of the Rhine River. The town there was Mannheim, Germany, across the river from there. On the east side was Mannheim, Germany. And we crossed them over to our side and put big fences up around the perimeter and had them in there by the thousands. I mean by the thousands. And every day they'd get a 2.5-ton truck and go through there and pick up the dead. There was always some that died overnight, injuries and stuff, because you couldn't treat them all. We've done the best we could to feed them, but there was so many of them that we couldn't take care of them like they did here. So we lost a few there. But the German soldier surrendered to us before he'd surrender to anybody else, because they knew they'd be treated right.
Why don't we open it up and just have some of the students, because they want to ask you questions.
Yeah.
Basically, let me tell you what we're doing just briefly for 2 seconds is we're doing about a 30,000 word book on the POW camp here, and there are 6 chapters, and the students are, for the most part, working in pairs. They've been through, as you're going to hear in a minute, hundreds of pages of National Archive documents. They've been through the Huntsville item, and several of them have military experience of their own. So they're bringing a whole wealth of information to this project from you know, their own life experience, also the documents. So why don't we open it up, just see what you, because they're all working on different things.
Yeah.
So let's see who's got questions.
And, Brad mentioned our topic of the Nazis and one of the problems at the camps, both at Hearn and at Huntsville, was American morale of the guards, and that it resulted in some treatment by the guards of things like confiscating POWs' property, not being very meticulous about keeping records, things like that, which surprised me in light of what we've been reading and hearing about the good treatment that they had. So my question was this, I mean, you're a 17-year-old, you enlisted, okay, Pearl Harbor happened. In your experience, did you find that an American of young age who gets assigned to work at a POW camp as a guard had any kind of, I guess, was disgruntled because, you know, why am I stuck here? Why am I fighting with the rest of the guys, you know, where the action is? Because I would think that might be an issue. A lot of guys might have felt that. Is that, did you experience that?
No, there was no issue there because I love the service. Because I wouldn't mistreat it at home. I was lacking something. And back then, all you young men wanted to be in the service. And there was never a time that I was in that camp that I know of anybody mistreating a prisoner or doing wrong. I mean, you had guards posted there. Before you couldn't enter a compound without being involved with officers. All officers were in charge at the gates and all. They had headquarters. They had an office building at the gate, and you went through a major there, and he'd run you through the ropes before you ever entered in there, and tell you what you couldn't do and what, and he'd tell you this day after day. Even he'd tell you, it didn't matter if he told you yes, he'd tell you the same thing the next day. And our prisoners were not mistreated. Now, I wouldn't say that some of these soldiers might have went in there and done something, but none of them was ever shot or ever beaten while I was there. These prisoners were model prisoners. And and when I'd go in there, I could go in there on a horse, and they wouldn't bother you. They went on about their business, and they'd look at you, you know, you'd be parading around on that horse from compound to compound, and when lunchtime come, I'd hit them kitchens. I'd tie the old horse on a gas meter in the back of the kitchen, tie him up and go in there and eat, and we would, that's a no-no, because you didn't eat their food. But I get in good with the cooks. Come on. And man, those people, they could cook, man. They were good. And anyhow, I never did get caught doing that. But we weren't supposed to do it. And that's the only rules I broke there was when I was invited to eat with them.
Did you find that, I think what Steve's kind of asking is, did you find that the morale of the guards themselves, I mean, that you all were pretty happy with the place where you were, were many people there eager to leave the camp and go into combat operations?
Now, here's another thing. We had guards there that come from North Africa, that were Americans that come from North Africa. They fought the war over there, and some of them had one eye, some of them injured. So when they sent them back here to finish their terms in the Army, their enlistments, they put them in places like that. And you had people in there that were pretty rough, these old-timers. I call old-timers, they're in their 30s. And they kind of thought they'd rule the roost, you know. Of course, they'd been over there and seen it all and come back. And the young boys like us, oh, we were nothing, man. You haven't been overseas yet. Wait till you go over there and get your dose of it, and then you can come back. Well, that's the only ones I could see possibly causing trouble. And there was trouble among us, amongst these soldiers there. There's a few fights and stuff like that, and taking stuff from one another, or dumping somebody's bed over when he's asleep or something, stuff like that, you know. But the only ones, the younger ones, they stayed out of that. We stayed out of it because we respected these veterans. I mean, veterans, war veterans. They'd been over there and gone through all of this. So I've always respected a veteran. And we had veterans when I was just in there, enlisted. We had veterans. I mean, they come from Africa and different, it's Sicily and all them places, right, where they'd been shot at, some of them, half of them wounded and all that. Mm-hmm. And but you had to respect people like that because they had to rank over you and everything. And they could tell you a lot of, keep you out of a lot of trouble, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just also wondering about the how being stationed at a POW camp as a guard, how soldiers approach that. I would imagine some might have felt it was, you know, they didn't like it because they'd rather be in combat, mm-hmm. or maybe they'd be glad to be there. The ones who were in combat would be glad, you know. But there's a lot of those emotions, I think, that could come into play if you're as a guard at a camp.
I was a guard at camp, and there were pranksters. The German printers were pranksters. Mm-hmm. We'd get these work details every day. Every day we'd get a work detail, maybe 8 to 10 men, put them on a truck and haul them off to do the outside work, ranch work and cutting timber and all this stuff. But the one day they were baling hay, pitching hay and with pitchforks and baling hay at the camp here in Riverside. And I was on riding old Joe that day. Well, this young prisoner, he decided he'd goose that horse with the pitchfork, see? And well, old Joe didn't like that. I went one way, he went the other. And but stuff like that, they were pranksters, but they didn't mean no harm by it. They just want the kids learning, pulling tricks on you. You had to watch that, because they do that. And but old Joe trotted on back to the corral. He left me. Joe, he knew where he belonged. He went back to the corral. About 30 minutes later, another rider brought him back. Says, here's your horse. What are you doing, boy? I says, I got pitched.
Let's let somebody from, okay, somebody from online have a question.
I have one.
All right, go ahead.
Did you leave before the riot that occurred where one of the officers was severely beaten by the German prisoners? From our records, we have a riot that occurred on 25 November in 1943 where they took over one of the compounds within the camp and beat several of the guards inside and prevented the other guards from getting in by creating a human blocking wave at the compound entrance. I was just curious if you were there during that time or if you had already left by that point.
I think I might have been there because I remember there was a disturbance in there. And there was a commission officer, American commissioned officer, went in there and done something. He had him out on the street and talking to him or something, and it started into an argument or something, and he got into it with him. But what happened there, I don't know. He didn't kill nobody. He might have got beaten, though. But I'm not sure of that. I may have been gone from the camp at the time, because I done back then. I know you asked a question about that, and I just can't completely answer it. I remember there was a disturbance in there one time that I know of, that it involved an American soldier. He was a commissioned officer, and he went in there and probably done something wrong. They didn't like it, so he probably got his tail whipped because. But other than that, these prisoners, you didn't have no problem with them. None. I don't care what they say. I was around them for about 9 months. And I hauled them from Huntsville to Lufkin on work detail. We had camps in Lufkin, Livingston, Nacogdoches Center. We had branch camps where we had 250 men in each camp from the main camp. Mm-hmm. And my job was transporting the sick and the food and the mail to these different camps. That was my job at one time. And I'd have maybe 10 or 20 or 12 prisoners on my truck, riding in the back of the truck. I had a revolver and a rifle in the cab. I had a small caliber rifle in the cab and a pistol. But whenever we'd stop, I never put that pistol on. That was there in case of emergency. You didn't carry a weapon because they could overwhelm you and kill you. See, if it was to come to that, but I wasn't worried about it. I never did worry about it. And when you put that, say if you had eight prisoners, you put one in charge at arrest, and they done what he said. You know, he kept them straight. And that was a good thing, right, that it worked with one another, see. And you'd always, if you were out doing detail work or something like on detail, you'd always appoint a prisoner. He had some kind of a little rank, but you'd appoint him to be in charge, keep him down. And that's the way it was. I mean, it all worked out. And I hauled prisoners from Alto out of Lufkin there, west of Lufkin. That was one of the main bases out of Lufkin there. And we had 250 there. But every day I'd bring some sick ones in and take replacements back. And I made that trip every day.
Now, what were they doing, working?
They were work camps. They worked farms and ranches and cut timber. They were, back then it was a lot of pulpwood cut. And you did, these prisoners would pair up. You'd get a detail and there'd be eight, there'd be four pair of them. You put two of them together, and they had so many board feet of timber to cut a day. And if you get two of them together that wanted to work and get it done, they could do it by noon. Then they had the rest of the day off. They could eat watermelons or whatever they could find around, or go swimming. They loved to go swimming. But that, we let them do that. I mean, as long as they didn't get out of sight. And I've guarded prisoners like that and hauled them around different places. I mean, often. I'd stop in Groveton, the Groveton Cafe in Groveton. I'd stop there and eat breakfast every morning when I go through there. And I'd leave my prisoners in the truck and I'd go in there and sit by a window and wash the truck. Mm-hmm. Be nobody with them.
How many prisoners were you in charge of on these details? How many guards to prisoners?
Well, whenever we travel, like whenever I haul these prisoners, I was by myself. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I'd have a rider, another GI with me, but very seldom. Now, on the details out in the woods where you had to spread them out to work, in the fields and all, you had prisoners according to how many, you had guards according to how many prisoners you had, in other words. And each detail would run from 8 to 10 prisoners. We call that a detail, a work detail. That was usually at a limit. And you had usually two guards. You had a driver and a guard. Because they'd be all over the place, these prisoners.
Amazing, a 17-year-old was guarding the prisoner. I mean, I have some 17-year-olds that I teach that I wouldn't trust with a stick of gum.
Yeah. When I was delivering them prisoners to Lufkin, mm-hmm. I'd go in there, and the captain would call me in. He says, we had about 250 prisoners there. You go find a cleaner's. And I want all these wool blankets and all this bedding done. This wool stuff had to be done stain clean. You go find a cleaner that can handle it. So I go to town. That was my job, too. I thought, they gave me a lot of detail, a lot of work. I go to town, and I located the Yancey cleaners. And I walked in there. There was about 4 women there. They were running the business because all the men were overseas, all in the service. So I said, I got a job for y'all. I don't know whether you can handle that. So I explained it to them, and they got the job. But I had to do that. And as far as fuel, if they needed fuel on the base or something like that, I had to locate areas where we could get it and buy it. The government paid for it, of course, you know. But I had to find out who'd handle it for us, if they would trust the government for doing this and that. Because when you pull in there with a convoy, it fill it up, fill your equipment up, and you drive off. And that all had to be reported, seen everything. And that part of my job, besides the carrying mail, that was very important. They wait for the mail truck. That was me. When I brought the groceries into the camps, the mail was there. Those prisoners got mail at least once a week from home. And they were allowed one letter a month, I think. If I'm not mistaken, 1 or 2 letters a month they could send home. They could write and send home. Mm-hmm. Each prisoner got paid. The government charged the ranch owner or whoever the prisoners were working, the land they were working on, they charged the ranch owner, the farmer, 80 cents per prisoner a day. 80 cents. That prisoner got they put that in the bank for the prisoner. They gave him food, they gave him stamp for the PX. He could even get one beer a week. They were allowed one beer a week. The PX had the cigarettes, can and stuff, and they work off of they give them tickets for that. And that's how, if they were working, if they were on work details, they got those privileges.
Right.
And the prisoner, I think, I'm not sure, but I think the working prisoners had breakfast and supper, lunch. And they took a bag with the midday meal on detail.
Right.
So they'd get 3 meals a day. And the ones in the compound that didn't work and just played soccer, they got, I think, 2 meals a day. I'm not sure, but I think it was 2 meals a day. But if you want work detail, they got the regular meals, 3 meals. So.
All right, let's see. Okay. Donna's got a question.
I want to ask you a question. Okay, my mother, on her end of it, she was processing detail work, okay?
What?
She was actually doing the paperwork or processing to get them out on those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
She also screened the mail. Their mail, the prisoner's mail.
Yeah, that was always, you have to screen that. It was a must.
She was on it, didn't mm-hmm. that? Okay. And she always talked about, you know, of course they were sent to where you say, the other camps, farms, this and that. She always talked about the Denison Dam. Do you recall sending any of the prisoners or going with them to the Denison Dam? And
no.
They more or less built that dam.
Okay. Now, I remember we took about 200 or 300. I don't forget the number, but we took them to New Mexico. These prisoners from this camp, and we moved them to New Mexico. They had a place for them to, they had work to do over there, so I don't know what it was, because it's all secret anyway.
Yeah.
But they put them in boxcars. We were all in boxcars. Everybody traveled by boxcar. Then they convert these things into where you could sleep in them and eat in the same car. And we took about a trainload of them into Mexico, dropped them off and turned right back and come here. Now, what they done, I don't know. I don't know what they were doing over there, but they did. They moved them around, shifted them around.
Yeah.
But I don't recall that. You see, I was the camp was there before I got there, and I was there so many months, and then it was there after I left. So a lot of that I missed out on.
Yeah.
I missed out on. And like the problem that you're talking about, a riot inside, I may have been gone.
Yeah.
But we've had a couple of little incidents, but I don't think, I may have not been there. Because I got there, the camp was already there. And when I left, the camp was still there. And when these prisoners went home, they had a little allotment coming. Because they put that was their money. And they could go home on that and start over, see. And from what I understand, too, any prisoner that had good conduct and got out good without any trouble could enlist, could write up, he could stay in the state for 10 years and prove himself, he'd be a citizen. He could stay here. They were allowed that. And a few of them done it. He showed me a picture of a guy that lives in the woodlands across from him. He probably was one of, I don't know whether he's a prisoner or not, this guy in this book. But
Brad, we're getting some feedback on your end.
Using the bathroom. No, I've been talking all this time. If you've got questions, give them to me. Let me have it.
Were there any specific prisoners that you like remember? Like, was there anyone that you, I don't want to say friends with, but someone that you specifically remember?
I'll tell you, the only, I can remember as a group, or hundreds of them. And I can describe what they look like and everything, but as far as having, getting that close to them, no way. And that was, 66 years ago, so the names kind of fade away. Like Donna there. I'd forgot about Donna until somebody mentioned her. But that's the way it is. It starts fading on you. I'm lucky to have the knowledge I still carry on. But now the prisoners, when I went to Germany, when I got into Germany, I visited a lot of the families. I could do that because I was in a position where I met a lot of Germans over there, lots of families, because I was an advanced scout. We went into different places ahead of some of the fighters even. We went in Paris, they always wanted to know about the prisoners, how they were treated here and all. And when they find out about how they were treated and all, of course they get to ride home and do that too. But I was always invited in the people's home. Be sure to come back. I want the neighbors to hear this. And they always wanted information from us, you know, the ones that were guarded and prudent, and always had a good word for them. So I got in good with these people. I could eat the sauerkraut if they had any potatoes. I could eat that. If you had any champagne, it'd come from France. We got a little bit of that. But, no, that book right there will give you the idea how cruel these people were. These are dictators. They're cruel. They were cruel. If they didn't like your looks, they'd kill you. Yeah, I need that done. I put my fingernail in that, yeah. Mm-hmm. You seen me doing that? That'll do it. Thank you.
I got another one if you need it.
That's okay. I kept bleeding probably all over me now.
Well, I missed your question, Don. I'm sorry.
Well, I was asking because my mother sent. She processed them for detail work.
Mm-hmm. She done.
I was asking him because she emphasized that the Denison Dam. They sent so many to work on it. Mm-hmm. And I guess they must have more or less built that dam. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if he had remembered any of that. And he said he
had. Could have been either before or after, yeah. But we wouldn't involved in that.
All right. Well, somebody else from online? We haven't heard from you guys in a while.
I've got a question.
Okay.
I'm working on the building of the camp, and there's from the documents, it looks like the camp is opened in September of 42, but then there's other documents well into 43 where they're changing, add this. I was wondering how much of the camp really was completed when you were there.
The camp was. There was no construction on the camp while I was there. Seems like all the construction had already been done. The barracks were all there. Our barracks were there, and the compounds were already built. They might have put up a couple buildings like the where they distributed the shoes and clothing and everything. They might have added that later, but there was. Three buildings there on that. There's one left. On that, it's a ranch now. That ranch, that was a ranch before the government got it, and it's a ranch. They turn all it back to a ranch. But I can't. I don't recall any construction on that place. Now I can. I recall some of the construction that the prisoners done. And we had prisoners work on the very college here, as masonry. Because in Germany, it had no wood. Everything is made is masonry. Everything. And
so, do you want to describe a little bit about the just the way the camp looked and everything?
The camp was a drab-looking place. Drab. You look out there, and you could see all this tar paper. Yeah. You know what tar paper is?
Oh yeah.
Wrapped around these buildings. And they were drab looking, and you take the hospital, the German hospital, and that's the crudest thing. I've worked in modern hospitals, and you wouldn't have that in a bathroom in a modern house. This was terrible. The operating table had a little light up there. It was still there.
Yeah.
And when you went in there to get, except when you went to get in there, if you had any work done, get interviewed or anything. There was some wooden benches all the way around. That's where you sat. There were no cushions or nothing. It's crude stuff, all nailed together. And the same way with the operating room. Nothing was in the walls except electric wires. All your gas, medical gases and all was inside the room, right there. Mm-hmm. And that's what they work with. But they had good. They had good doctors. They done the best they could with them, and like, we never lost any in the hospital. That's for sure. The ones that had died from committed suicide. One drowning I know of, and about three suicides in this whole camp. And no killing of any kind. Nobody was shot or anything like that. But as a young man, I was, in other words, I was with soldiers my age, right there. It was easy to get along with them. So it's easy. We were the same age.
Well, does somebody else have a maybe another question from online or questions here? No, you're good. Okay.
To kind of piggyback off what Dale was saying, we're working on the same chapter, sir, and it seemed as if you talked about the construction already being done by the time you got there. We have letters back and forth from our engineers and our general stating that well into the late fall of 43, talking about the construction of the officers' quarters. And I know it was a big deal with y'all discussing
maybe.
The conventions and the fact that your COs and your enlisted men were supposed to be separated. Do you know of any intermingling there, or were those barracks completed by the time you got there?
You're talking about what month was that? It was in the fall, you said, when they were constructing the headquarters there?
Yes, sir. From our understanding, according to the Geneva Convention, the officers and the enlisted men were supposed to be separated into separate quarters. Is that correct?
Is that the German prisoners or the Americans?
The German prisoners, sir.
Well, no, they would... see, you didn't have a commissioned officers in that prison. Your highest ranking prisoner was non-commissioned. They had other prisons for these the officers somewhere else. But in that, we had our officers were over the non-commissioned officers of the German prisoners. Our officers were over, but they didn't have no German officers in there.
There was no German officers ever at Camp Huntsville.
No, they were all non-commissioned officer from a first sergeant down, like the Army. Your commissioned officer starts as lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
Well, there was nothing above sergeant. You had the equivalent of a top sergeant. That's the highest rank. It went down from there. But I don't know of any officers there. The officers that I knew there were our officers. And they had one building, office building, inside the compound that we had officers in. But there were no German officers that I knew of.
And the
documents be referring to the officers' quarters for the American officers?
It could have been the American officers. Could have very well been. See, I don't recall that at all, because the camp was built when I got there, and it didn't. There were no additions, unless maybe the quartermasters. They might have put a couple of big buildings up on the front where they had the quartermasters, more equipment in it.
The documents Chris is referring to talks about adding 1,000 officers as prisoners to Huntsville. But it's not real clear as to if that was ever accomplished or not.
All right, here's the thing. Now, I was there 9 months. It had to happen after I left, after I was moved from there and shipped out. But the thing is, there was nothing. They wasn't there when I left, that I know of. Right. There were no officers in there.
And certainly not 1,000. So.
Oh, that was a big project. You say, well, you had 1,000. That took another compound. You had to build another compound over there.
What about, I don't know, I had to walk out for a moment. The thing I'm interested in that you were talking about earlier, Titus, was the soccer and did you all talk about that? Was kind of extracurricular activities of the prisoners. I mean, what kind of things did they do for fun?
There were the prisoners. You had about a quarter of them worked. The rest stayed home.
Okay.
They ate and slept. But during the day, there was a constant action of soccer ball, calisthenics, weightlifting, everything. They were in physical condition, best physical condition I ever seen. Some of them were muscle bound, and they just looked like they were trim men. They were always fresh haircut, shaved. In America, one thing I remember, they get out there and march. These German prisoners, they march about once or twice a week, hundreds of them. They'd fall in formation, and you could hear them, that footsteps, and all of a sudden, all that singing, and they were all sing. It was one voice. It's the prettiest thing you ever heard. It was. It was really something to listen to. The way they'd done it. And everybody sang, they were organized, right, and in step. And they'd sing them songs when they were marching all the time. All the time. We never did do that.
Did they have, were there movie theaters at the?
We had a movie theater at the recreation hall. We had a on our part of the base. Right. And I think the prisoners were allowed there. If I'm not mistaken, there were nights they could go there. Under heavy guard, of course, you know. They make sure they were all in the building and all. And I'm pretty sure they had. And that's what we got. For us, we had buses of women, of girls coming from this college over there at that recreation hall. We'd have a dance once a week, or and they all come from Sam Houston College here. Yeah, they did have dances. We always had that. They'd bring a band or something, and we'd have a big time.
I mean, that's an item, right?
Yeah, we sure did. That we'd look forward to that. Busloads of girls come in, and we'd go dancing. We'd go to the recreation hall and dance.
What else? What other? Y'all have any questions?
But you were there before the prisoners came, correct?
Before they came?
Yes.
No, ma'am. I was there after they were here.
Okay.
See, the prisoners I guarded more or less while I was there were from Africa.
Right, but the camp was open before, was in operation.
Oh, yeah, it was in operation
but
before.
You came after the prisoners.
All the camp was built. The compounds, our barracks was all there and everything. And it was already here. And it was a shock when you look out there because you expect, I don't know, it just different.
Right.
It was different. You knew it was military.
Were you limited on what you could discuss about the camp and the prisoners outside?
That's something we had to watch. In other words, like, if I can remember right, we weren't allowed to take photographs. And there's a lot of things we couldn't do. Is let the prisoners fraternize with other people. If they're going to fraternize, it'd be with the soldier, not the civilians. They had nothing to do with the civilians, nothing. And
what did you think? How did the people the prisoners worked for think the prisoners worked? Were they these people who did the pulpwood or the cotton or whatever? Were they happy generally?
The thing is, they wanted to be out. They wanted to be away from the camp. And a lot of them enjoyed their work. And they got 3 meals a day and they got paid for it. It wasn't but 80 cents a day, but it went into the kitty. Whenever they went back home to Germany, they had that money to spend. They could start over again. So. And a prisoner over here, if he was a model prisoner, he had a chance. If he could stay here 10 years, if I'm not mistaken, and prove himself, he could be an American citizen. He could stay here, so. But he had to prove himself. There was a limit in there. And they had that opportunity.
How were the people who owned, like, farms in Walker County or out in Lufkin, and these prisoners would come out there and work, how did the owners of the land, what did they think about the prisoners?
A lot of them, they were weary of them. You know, I mean, this is, well, one guard for so many prisoners. I don't like that or something. He might have thought that.
Yeah.
But it's a, now you couldn't get one to just bust its bottom out to work. But he'd do his job. If you gave him a job, he'd do it. And when we go to these different places with these prisoners, we'd get with the owner, and he'd tell us what he wanted. Then we'd get the prisoners to do it. He didn't get out there and boss the prisoners. He was out of that. He just told whoever's in charge of the prisoners, I want this done, I want that done, and we guided the prisoners that way. And like I said though before, I was telling you that a work detail to cut pulp wood, for instance. Two prisoners were supposed to cut so many board feet of timber a day. And two good working prisoners could do it in a half a day if he wanted to. So there wasn't no real labor there. It was just some of them would take a whole day. Some of them never get their board feet cut.
Did the owners of the property provide food and refreshments for the prisoners?
No. When the prisoner left the front gate, when he left the gate of the compound, he had a lunch. Each one had a lunch that was always prepared for him. They got the working prisoners got three meals a day. And if they worked out, they'd take a lunch with them. A lunch was packed for them, especially packed for them.
Except for the watermelons, right?
And man, the watermelons, they'd give the watermelon. They'd hit a watermelon patch and destroy it. And they loved to go swimming. You'd hear a couple of them whooping and hollering over there in the creek, strip naked, plumb naked, just going swimming, boy. Take all that clothes and go swimming. But something else. They were comical, real comical. They were pranksters, really.
Mr. Field knows about watermelon. I mean, he's like a professional gardener, basically. He's got quite a orchard, basically, at your house.
I have my own thing going at home. Okay. I always have. Yeah. See, when I was a young boy, my dad, during the Depression, would come in from grade school. You boys get a hoe and get out there and chop weeds and work that garden. You didn't play. You went out there and worked. And on weekends, you might get a chance to meet some boy and maybe go play ball or something, you know. And otherwise, you were out there in the garden. And I said to myself when I was about 12 years old, I said, man, I'll never have a garden. I said, that's not for me. I wouldn't be without one. I've always been like that. Here's my experience. I went into service and got out. I worked the oil field in different odd jobs and finally got into plumbing. And now I was a master plumber for it. I ended up as a master plumber. But anyway, I was a fisherman, a hunter, and a trapper. You wouldn't believe this, in Louisiana. My dad and I bought a shrimp boat, and we were shrimping. We were fishermen. Then we got a trapping camp, muskrat, mink, and otters and stuff. And there's a lot of that in Louisiana and in swamp country. I've done that. And I was also a hunter. I believed in bringing in food all my life. I go anywhere, I'm going to bring something back to eat. Now, I don't go out there for foolishness. It's always something that counts. And I was a plumber here in Houston, making about $7,000 a year then as plumbing. I'd go over in Louisiana in 3 months trapping. I'd make $7,000 to $11,000 in 3 months trapping. So there was money in it.
Oh yeah.
And that's how I got on my feet. I married this woman and got on my feet, like everything. I got to where we charge at Sears and all that, and you'd never get it paid. Yeah. It's a revolving plan, you know. Yeah. I said, man, that's it. And first thing you know, I'll pay every up to this day. Yeah. When we first got married, I No charging. Everything cash. Yeah. Everything. And that's been going on for 62 years.
Yeah.
But I've got a good woman.
Yeah.
I've got a good
and
woman.
And she cooks good, I bet you.
She kept, if it wouldn't been for her, I wouldn't have nothing. I'd probably be gone by now. Gambling and running around and drinking and all that. She put a stop to that. And it worked. It worked. Because as soon as that happened, we started accumulating. Mm-hmm. I like that yeah. accumulating.
Yeah.
You could buy cars, you yeah. could do this, and you didn't have to borrow money and this and that. I like that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Fields, for coming up. Well, I'm going to go over some of what we've done, and I think we'll come up with questions as we go.
Okay.
So, because we've got to...
One other little thing.
Okay, go ahead.
One other little thing. I was in World War II. I went to Europe. When Hitler committed suicide, my captain says, "How old are you, young man?" I says, 19. He says, "You're going to the Pacific." They put me on a ship. I ended up in the Pacific. So I served in both theaters.
In Texas.
Yeah. I went to Europe, went to England when they were bombing. The V-2 bombs, the 1 and 2, would come over. If you heard him, you were safe because he didn't pass you. If you didn't hear that bomb, it's falling on you. It's coming down on you. And I've seen some devastation there. We'd be somewhere, and you'd hear that thing, and I'd get on the table or something, everybody laughs. It's gone now. And I was over there in Japan, the Philippines, where they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. I says, "Well, that's the end of the war." It didn't end. 2 days later, Nagasaki, they dropped another one. I said, they're gonna surrender sooner or later if we keep dropping them bombs over there. But in that book, they showed you the devastation. Right in that book, there's two pictures in there, the devastation. And I've seen what Hiroshima looked like by rail. Had a rail line up in the mountain, on the mountainside that went around Hiroshima. Hiroshima's in a bowl. Nothing. All you had was a street laid out. Every building, everything was gone, wiped out. And that was we were five miles from where the bomb exploded. And the trees and the leaves and everything was scorched up 5 miles away from the heat. And that's a small bomb.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I got to see a lot of things in my lifetime.
I know. By the time you were 20.
I've got to do a lot of things, too, in my lifetime.
Well, I'm sure we'll think of more questions, but I want to go over some of what they're doing, talk with them, have them contribute, and then, you know, if and when they come up with more questions, we'll definitely ask you.